Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike Kasap, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. Steve Philpott is a former U.S. Marine, graduate student, and cannabis researcher at Chicago State University, and co-founder for the Illinois Minority Growers Association. Here, their mission is to close the disparity gap by addressing socioeconomic related barriers for minorities. They're seeking to educate growers by providing information services and partnerships that afford them increased access to Illinois' agricultural industry. Steve grew up on the south side of Chicago in the aftermath of the war on drugs. He was constantly transferring schools during his elementary years, while his mother looked for better work and safer neighborhoods. At an early age, he was exposed to things most kids aren't, and as he admits, instead of focusing on school, he turned outward and tried to figure out the situation around him. After barely graduating high school, he turned to the Marines, a place he knew would accept him for who he was. He became a part of that brotherhood, serving several years as an artillery specialist. An injury, however, forced him into early separation from the Marines, which then followed closely by an opioid-related death of a close friend. These two events catapulted Steve into a life of education, research, service, and opportunity creation for his community. I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I did.
I was born and raised in Chicago. Lived most of my time just with me and my mom, jumped around, transferred schools every year from first to eighth grade. So I've lived all around the city in different parts. Went to high school in the southwest suburbs, and I always tell people kids aren't in control of their environment, right? So kids are exposed to whatever they're exposed to. And I saw a lot of different aspects of life growing up that affected me as a child. So, you know, when I graduated high school, barely, you know, the Marines is an awesome place because they take people who may not necessarily on paper seem like, you know, hey, you don't have a 4.0 GPA, you're not an all-American, you know, football player, but there's a place for you where you can mean something and really show how much you as a person, how much you matter to your country. So the Marine Corps was a great place for me. And, you know, as a 19-year-old, I graduated high school with a 1.9 GPA. I mean, literally the lowest you can graduate with. And the Marines really, it was like a brotherhood. You know, they took me in and really, really laid the groundwork for a lot of, really my mindset more than anything. Everything that I do nowadays, I've realized that Marine Corps mindset, and Mike, you know, I don't have to tell you, it makes you like a hot knife and you cut through a lot of the crap in life. And you get exactly where you want to be. So, I mean, I give the Marine Corps a lot of credit for kind of giving me that skill set, you know, mentally and physically to navigate life and get me where I am today.
You mentioned because of how often you guys moved and the different parts of the city that you saw, that you also experienced and saw different aspects of life growing up. Can you kind of give us a sense of what some of those things that you experienced were early in life, perhaps prior to most, that have kind of stuck with you?
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, a lot of people see Chicago, right, on the news, and they're like, you know, what is going on there? You know, what's going on? And what a lot of people don't realize is the war on drugs destroyed a lot of inner cities across the country. And we didn't really pay attention to the fallout afterwards, right? It was like the war on drugs. At some point in time, it kind of slowed down, but the people who lived in those communities were still affected. So, I mean, I legitimately transferred schools first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth and seventh. I stayed in the same school. And in eighth grade, I transferred schools again because we were just trying to move to safer neighborhoods. My mom would get a new job, a higher paying job, and we would try to get out of that neighborhood and go to the better school. And as a kid, I was just like, man, why is my mom always picking up and just moving? But she was legitimately trying to provide a better way of life. That was kind of my early childhood, but it made me very aware. I was one of those kids that maybe was a little too smart, asked a little, you know, one too many questions. But it was because of my perspective of how I grew up. And again, I mean, that is another part of, you know, that adversity that ends up making you an adult that's, you know, has a little more compassion, a little more empathetic towards other people from different walks of life, people who live across the city who maybe, you know, are portrayed one way on TV. But I've lived in the communities with these people. Some of these people are my friends, right? So that's really kind of what that whole early childhood means to me to this day going forward, because I still live in Chicago after having traveled the world, living in San Diego. People are like, man, you lived in San Diego and all these beautiful places and you end up back in Chicago. So, yep, it's because I love it and I really want to have an impact on the city and, you know, kind of give an opportunity to kids that were in a situation that I was in. If you look back, was the war on drugs is a kind of a flag to put in the ground of when our inner city started looking a certain way. And that's something, you know, through what I'm doing now, I'd also like to kind of get that message out there that we're all people, we're all humans, right? Kids aren't born malicious. But just like any kid, any race, any nationality, anywhere on the planet, when opportunity lacks, kids are creative and they find ways to get opportunities, good or bad. So that's kind of, you know, after moving around the city and meeting so many different people from different walks of life, I was like, I don't know if there's any bad people, you know, just like kids that are just born bad. But there's definitely people that are exposed to situations that, you know, they get to a certain point and, you know, when people say by any means necessary, I don't think some people have been hungry enough to really say that, because somebody who's hungry, by any means necessary, is a totally different thing. So
environment's such a huge factor in that. And oftentimes the environment, as in, it sounds like your case is largely out of your control. You know,
of course. And I mean, even, you know, in 2015, there was a recent surge in crime again in Chicago, but nobody talks about the fact that 45 public schools were closed in 1 year. It was the largest mass school closing in United States history. So when you see the crime that people talk about in Chicago right now, if you look at the data in 2015, crime was trending downwards before that happened. And as you see on a national news, you know, everywhere, it's increasing every single year. But you have to think, these are children, American children, that have lost opportunities. You know, they're getting on public transportation at 5 a.m. to go to the other side of town to go to first grade. That's crazy. So
why did they close the schools?
They said it was funding. You know, they said, hey, you know, these schools aren't performing very well. If we close them and we redirect the funding to some of the better performing schools and just, you know, make those kids go there, you know, that can, there's all these theories as to why it happened, but the truth is these schools were all, you know, in neighborhoods where, you know, the people look like me, and those are the same people who are being portrayed on the news. It's just like, hey, you know, there's this violence going on the south side and the west side, and it's just like, hey man, the war on drugs, the projects closing, largest mass school closing in U.S. history, that's like a perfect storm for violence. Right. Mm-hmm. So my big thing, you know, through everything I'm doing in agriculture and as a U.S., you know, former U.S. active duty U.S. Marine, I want to provide opportunities. And I believe that urban agriculture is the way, you know, as us being the third largest city in the United States and Illinois being the third largest export of agricultural goods in the U.S.
Because of all of these different perspectives that you had prior to joining the Marines, how do you think that affected your approach to the Marine Corps? We were coming in from with such a different mindset than I can imagine most of the, you know, me in particular or personally, but lots of other folks coming in that don't have that same exposure that you did. How did that mesh, so to speak, with the community you were coming into with the Marines?
Yeah, honestly, I would say that the one benefit to having moved around so much is I was exposed to totally different people. You know, Chicago is very, it's very split up. Honestly, it's very segregated. And I got to live amongst a lot of different people who look different than me. And joining the Marines, it is a, as you know, it's just like, hey, I get that you're from the North, you're from the South, you're from the East, you're from a metropolitan area, you're from a rural area, but we are all American and we all have one goal right now. And that was something that I could totally get behind, because I was like, yo, I was told that there was something wrong with me. You know, you have behavioral problems. You got a 1.9 GPA. You're always suspended. You're always expelled. And then I get to boot camp with this chip on my shoulder and I end up, you know, as a squad leader and I end up performing well. And I'm like, whoa, I'm not a loser. You know what I mean? I actually am a human that matters to people around me, and I can do something for my country at the same time. It's just like, so I was, honestly, I tell people my first year and a half, I was like a bull. I didn't remember much. I wanted to get out of Chicago. I knew that with my GPA, my history of like grade school suspensions and different things like that, I was like, man, this is the, you know, I have the profile of what they say you're going to turn into, you know, this person, there's no opportunity. This kid, what's he going to do? He doesn't have good grades. He's going to end up on the streets. And I was like, I'm not a bad kid, but honestly, I was exposed to some crazy stuff as a kid and I just need to get my stuff straight. The Marines gave me the, man, it was like jumping off a diving board into the ocean. You know, it was really just like an endless possibility. It was, you know, when the recruiter sits you down and they're just like, they have like 10 little cards and they're like, flip over the cards that you want. And it's like, all right, I can make money, check. It's like, I can serve my country, yeah, check. Travel the world, just give me those three and I'm good right there.
What'd you do in the service? How long were you in?
Yeah, so I was in from 2009 to 2013, and I'll talk about my injury and when I ended up leaving, but I was a 2131 towed artillery specialist, so I worked on howitzers, good friends with the infantry people. So I worked on the howitzer itself. I did all the maintenance, but also I was the battery mechanic for Lima Battery 310. And we ended up deploying in 2013. And I was, as a lance corporal, I was in charge of a battery, six guns, six cannons by myself. And I think back now, I'm just like, man, you were 19, 20 years old. You know, people told you you had a 1.9 GPA, but the job that you ended up getting in the Marines was you were in charge of keeping six cannons operational. So the other 100 plus people in your unit actually have, you know, this is the only reason that we're even a unit, is because of these six cannons, and it is your job. No one else knows how to operate them like you do. And the sense of pride that it gave me as a 19, 20 year old kid, I mean, again, Marines, we walk with our heads very high, right? And it's because we do more with less. And just being an artillery technician, working on those cannons. When I wasn't working on the cannons, I was a lance corporal, right? So the corporals were like, yo, you're part of the gun crew. So I used to hump rounds when all my guns were running. You know, I grab artillery rounds and just jump on the gun crew. So
you said you deployed, or your unit was about to deploy, but there was an injury.
No. So, I deployed in 2011. We were part of a response 310. So we got connected to 2-2, and we ended up deploying for a little over a year. You know, we went on a good old 22nd MEW. I think we were somewhere, you know, around when you all were getting deployed. Mm-hmm. Went to a bunch of different places, Libya, Djibouti, Africa, ton of different places, Oman. But I actually didn't realize this. I had a fracture in my fibula and didn't know it. I thought it was just a really, really bad ankle sprain. I got two cortisone shots while I was on deployment. One of our docs was like, hey, if you need to, if it's really, really bad and your foot's swelling like this and you can't get your boot off, we can send you home. Sorry about that. We can send you home if you need to go home. And I was just like, from deployment? You're insane. Like, nobody else knows my cannons. Nobody knows my guns. Mm-hmm. They're very intricate. And as you know, like, every single rifle is different. Every cannon is different. And I was terrified of leaving my guys behind because my ankle hurt. Right. I didn't know it was actually, I had a fracture, but it was enough for me to stay on deployment and keep going. Long story short, when we came home from deployment, I went to see a doctor and he was like, hey, you have some new bone growth in your ankle. I was like, cool. Like, nah, man, new bone growth. It looks like you had a fracture and it possibly healed wrong. So right around when I was, you know, deliberating, hey, do I reenlist? Do I stay in? I was meritoriously promoted to corporal after deployment. And I was like, man, you know, this is the first time I've ever felt like a winner. Honestly, it's the first time, you know, because of my billet, because my job was unique. You know, I got to deal with everybody from chief warrant officer, you know, high ranking, to first sergeants, to the actual, gun units themselves, people around my rank, the enlisted. So I got to kind of, again, be in different circles in the Marines the same way I've been my entire life. And when it came time to reenlist, you know, I was just like, man, my ankle's broken. And they just put, you know, a bunch of screws and rods in my leg. And I don't know if I can continue. I've always been a bigger guy anyway. I was 212, which is like the limit for being 6 feet. which is crazy. Yeah. I was already at the limit, and I noticed myself having trouble keeping weight off and just staying fit and running. I had a lot of time issues recovering. I had a second surgery later on after I actually got out the Marines. So my goal, I started taking classes in fitness and health and exercise before I actually left active duty, so that it could set me up to, learn about the body, what happened to me, and what's happened to other people that I know, you know, that have had physical injuries while they were in the service.
When you and I first spoke, you described a story with I believe it was another Marine, that something happened to him that sort of set you on part of the path that you're on today. Would you mind sharing that story with the listeners so they can get a sense of what that was and why it moved you in that direction?
Yeah, for sure. It used to be really difficult to talk about, and it's something that I kind of hope other service members are more willing to bring up and talk about. But had a close buddy of mine. He had deployed to Afghanistan before, I think once or twice before I'd even met him. Super cool. Everybody knows the Lance Corporal with the chip on their shoulder, been deployed. You're just like, man, this guy's like a dream. You know, everybody, when you meet those people, if you're in the Marines, you know exactly what I'm talking about. You're just like, man, this guy is it. And we ended up deploying, and I actually don't remember now if it was while we were deployed or right before, but he actually was dealing with a lot of PTSD symptoms. And I know that I don't remember exactly what happened, but I do know that he overdosed from opioids. And that was kind of the first jarring, just like, I've lost Marines, right? That, you got guys, they go out and, they don't come back home, and it's really hard. But losing Marines stateside that have deployed, losing them to PTSD and opioids, it hits a lot different. And I don't think a lot of people think about that when they think about that 22 vets a day, right? These are people's family. Again, these are Americans, regardless of what they look like and where they're from. And, for us to support our troops the way that we shout when it comes election time, that number's jarring. And I know I'm not the only person that's felt that feeling before. And I didn't know exactly in the moment how I was going to have some type of impact, but I knew I didn't want that to just be, just this pain that just sat on my chest for the rest of my life. If I could help one other person not go through that same situation, I to the day I take my last breath, I will, and I am doing that. So I actually ended up losing two other Marines, to similar situations after I got out the Marines. And the Vietnam vet, greatest words he's ever given me, he said, "Don't wait till you guys get old and start dying off. Go do something now. Help your brothers out now." So that's kind of, that's been my mindset no matter what job I've had, what career I've had since I've got out the Marines. And I'm finally in a place now where I have a platform, a career, some education behind me where I can really spread that knowledge, because it is important that we think about it. We think about improving our society as a whole in America. I think one of the biggest things it starts with is quality of life post-service for our veterans.
You also had, when you broke your leg or your ankle and you were going through your surgeries, they also prescribed you opioids. Correct?
Correct. So one of the biggest conflicts I've ever had while I was in the Marines was actually, they gave me opioids, to your point, after, and I don't remember how many, but I remember it was a lot. The day I had my surgery, they gave me a nerve block in order to drill screws through your bone. And my doctor, he gave me this bottle and he was like, "Hey, make sure you take this because the nerve block's going to wear off." I'm like, "Doc, I feel fine. The drugs are still pumping through your system. I'm good, doc. Don't worry about it." I got home. Didn't take the medicine like he told me to. Woke up the next morning, breaking out in hives, hyperventilating. And my body was going into shock. So I ended up having to take the medicine. I was taking it, and about halfway through my prescription, I realized that I was having some crazy, just visual, very, very vivid, they're called nightmare loops. So I was having sleep paralysis, which is where, you're conscious, but you can't move, you can't get up. And I was having sleep paralysis paired with nightmare loops. And the nightmare loops, it's kind of like reverse Inception, right? That crazy movie. I would go to sleep, I'd have a nightmare, and then I'd wake up from the nightmare, but I didn't actually wake up. It was another nightmare that was starting over. And I realized the more I took these opioids, the more vivid they got. my blood pressure was off the charts. Doctors could not figure out why my blood pressure was so high. I was kind of panicked to go to sleep every night because of how the opioids made me feel. And then living on the west side of Chicago after I got out of the Marines, that's a combat zone. So it's like between these two things, my blood pressure was really high and the opioids weren't making me feel right. So I thought about, you know, the Marines that I lost. And honestly, one day I just threw the bottle away. And it was a very difficult thing for me because I know now you're not supposed to just cut off cold turkey, but those nightmares and things continued for a while. I had a buddy while I was in service. He had cancer twice as a child. And he was like, "Hey man, why don't you try cannabis?" I was like, "Dude, you are joking right now. You know what I mean? I worked hard to finally make a good name for myself in the Marines, right? I'm getting these awards. I'm getting promoted. I deployed. Like, I'm feeling good. And I'm just going to do whatever they tell me to do. I know you're saying that opioids are harmful, but it's the law, right? So I'm going to follow the law, even if it's harmful to my own body. I don't want to try cannabis." And that's kind of, right, that mindset, that seed, pun intended, that was planted, it's always been there. And I've always wondered, is this guy crazy? Like, what is he talking about, this plant? You know, are you telling me that my guys that I lost, you know what I mean, the people that were losing every day, are you telling me that this plant could be an opioid alternative? If so, I'm all in. And that was the snowball that has turned into an avalanche in my life, really in agriculture, urban agriculture. And, you know, we'll get into cannabis as a crop as well.
Connect those dots from the interest you were starting to have in exercise physiology to ultimately getting into the research space within cannabis. When did you get out? What did that sort of very next foot out the door look like? And then how did those subsequent steps move you into research in the cannabis space?
My associate's degree at community college was in applied health science. So it was in fitness and exercise. So I ended up being a personal trainer after breaking my leg, just learning about mindset and psychology and those different things. I was just interested in what makes us tick. How do we work, right? Like humans on our smallest form, what's going on? So became a personal trainer after I graduated from my associate's program in 2015. But to me, it wasn't enough. I wanted a little more knowledge. I wanted to know more about the body. So I enrolled at University of Illinois Chicago, here in Chicago, obviously, as a kinesiology undergraduate. I spent 2 years there studying human physiology, kinesiology, and nutrition. And that is kind of where my mind got blown. I was just like, hey, you know, there's a lot more to us than people really understand. We're not just these, I call us meat bags sometimes. We're not just these meat bags walking around, right? We have conscious thoughts, we have feelings, right? The things that we consume can affect that. So something like opioids, right? How could opioids give me nightmares and night tremors, right? How could chemicals that come from cannabis, simulate the therapeutic and medicinal effects of these opioids, right? So I'm having all these thoughts. And during human physiology and kinesiology and nutrition, I'm learning about how everything we put in our body, from medicine to food, on a cellular level, right, on a molecular level, how those things intertwine. And after graduating from UIC, honestly, had the best time of my life. I spent 6 years as a collegiate strength conditioning coach. I spent some time interning at Northwestern. I spent some time at University of Illinois Chicago, where I graduated from McKendree University, some private facilities, Parisi Speed School. Most recently, I coached at Chicago State University. During the pandemic, you know, like so many other people, I really had to take a step back and evaluate where I was. I felt that the sports industry was going to take a big hit. And during the pandemic, I really started thinking about the veterans. You know, social distancing affected a lot of us. But for veterans, that was hard for a lot of people who are isolated like that. And I really needed to make a big life decision. And with the legalization of cannabis recreationally here in Chicago, I became interested in how I could use my scientific background in kinesiology and human nutrition and kind of cross over and delve into the science of this cannabis plant, which again, in the back of my mind, I've always wondered, how is this plant, you know, this plant, how is this plant able to have these, you know, mass therapeutic and medicinal ranges, you know, now that we know epilepsy, PTSD, MS, Alzheimer's, all these different conditions. So I took a bunch of online certifications to try to learn about cannabis. And, you know, they were all really just talking about consuming. If you Google cannabis right now, it's so difficult to get past consumption in dispensaries. I wanted to learn the science of the plant itself. After, you know, kind of banging my head on the wall enough and realizing I couldn't find anything online, you know, I said a prayer and I quit my corporate job and I returned to school. And that's where I am right now. I'm currently just finished my first year. I have one semester left. I just thought about that. So I have one semester left, just research. I am a graduate student at Chicago State University. And my thesis is in the biosynthesis of secondary metabolites. So essentially I'm looking into the variation of genetically identical cannabis clones and showing how you know, things like cannabinoids and terpenes, right? The things that give us those medicinal and therapeutic effects, how those can change just by changing the color of light that you expose the plant to. So that is what my current research is in, and I'm hoping that it helps a lot of policy. We say above 0.3% THC is marijuana, and we say below 0.3% THC is hemp, but it's all the same plant. And I've realized we went straight past agriculture, right? The people who are plant specialists, and we went straight into sales, dispensaries, and consumption. And if veterans and other people are going to be using this plant as their alternative to opioids, it would behoove us as a society to really look into the science of this plant first.
Is there a pathway right now to take some of the insights that you and others are gathering from a research standpoint and try to apply those towards an alternative to opioids within the military constructs?
Yeah, for sure. So I actually recently, within the last couple months, I've joined Veterans Action Council. Veterans Action Council is awesome. It's just a group of veterans that all get together, all different walks of life, unique experiences. But some of these veterans actually have direct experience legally through the DEA being prescribed cannabis as an alternative to opioids. Because a lot of people know that, you know, that was a thing. But the issue with that is, because the DEA has cannabis as a Schedule I distinction, the only cannabis that these people who were a part of this program were able to receive from the DEA came from one place, one university, and that was University of Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And what we know now is a lot of that cannabis was, you know, not of a high quality and also not representative on a chemical level of what we consume today. And what we know from, you know, being veterans is that anywhere in the country, people are going to treat themselves how they feel proper, right? Any way that they can operate and they can function. So veterans shouldn't have to hide, right? If cannabis really is an opioid alternative and it really is a crop, you know, specialty crop, that's all it is. It's a plant, mm-hmm. but it's a special crop that has special medicinal uses, right? So my goal is to bring it down to a small level. Let's talk about agriculture. Let's talk about the plant science, and then let that plant science kind of guide the policy, because we could have a whole podcast just on why our policy doesn't make sense from a scientific level.
On a dumbed down level, Steve, talk to us about what your thesis is showing now with respect to different light variations and the kinds of cannabinoids that you can achieve with that adjustment, and why it would matter for the veteran community looking at cannabis as an alternative to opioids.
For example, if you're a hemp farmer and you're growing on the West Coast, your hemp has to remain below 0.3% THC. But with the wildfires going on, that smoke can actually absorb some of those that bluer light that we're used to, and you get this red tint in the sky. Mm-hmm. And that red tint, the plants know, right? That is a different type mm-hmm. of energy that they are receiving. And because of that, the plants can flower early. You can get plants that exhibit both male and female characteristics, or you can get plants that go hot. And what we call hot is testing above the federal limit. So we've created a law saying the hemp is below 0.3% THC, but scientifically that doesn't make sense if what we're saying is the environment can induce a spike in THC. THC is one of 113 discovered cannabinoids in the plant. We don't know how many of them have medicinal therapeutic values, but we need the federal government to kind of give us this policy to allow us to do more research. Mm-hmm. And that to the veterans perspective, in 2018 with the 2018 Farm Bill, none of us were talking about hemp. None of us were talking about CBD, right?
Right.
And then all of a sudden, 2018, Farm Bill and CBD legalized federally, right? Completely descheduled, taken off the list. It went from up there with everything else to removed from the list totally. And with that, the first federally approved drug with CBD was created. It's called Epidiolex. It is for one-year-olds and older with a very severe form of epilepsy. And it has a very successful, I mean, the FDA approved it because it is a successful treatment to this form of epilepsy that prior to had no known forms of treatment. So I'm just like, whoa, you know, you see that chain reaction, the policy happened, then the research happened, and we're saying that the plant has an ability to change, right? These compounds that we're looking for, it's almost like looking for a recipe, right? It's like, hey, what recipe of light is better for you? What recipe of fertilizer is better for you? I'm just looking at light because it's the easiest for me to isolate and measure and keeping all the other variables the same. And not even through my research, but just research that was done before, you know, we found out that blue light can increase cannabinoid production and red light can increase the actual biomass, the actual physical leaves and the stems of the plant. And I'm like, man, if we're able to manipulate the structure, able to manipulate the biosynthesis of these metabolites, you know, maybe a veteran can grow their own medicine at home, or maybe we can cultivate medicine on a large scale that is specific towards a certain ailment. Because right now we're telling veterans, cannabis helps PTSD, cannabis does this, cannabis does that. The truth is, cannabis, like everything else we consume, is not without harm. Have too much caffeine, see what happens. Quit caffeine, cold turkey, see what happens, right? So it's not, we don't have to shy away from the fact that there are risks. I would rather do the research and tell people, like, hey, if you're consuming THC that's aged into CBN, CBN may give you paranoia. It may make you really sleepy or sluggish. It may have a more narcotic-like effect. These are things we're not talking about. These are things that, you know, the scientists, the plant scientists, the people in agriculture, they understand these things, but if it's not in policy, again, it starts from policy at the top and it trickles its way down. So
in today's cultivation, how do you maintain the THC level at 0.3 or below for hemp, or 0.3 and above for medical marijuana or other, you know, more cannabis type product? How's that done today genetically?
It's very difficult. Okay. Because it is a matter of nature and nurture. So very important, right? So two, like, very, very, very fundamental, but probably the most important things that go unspoken. So THC and CBD both come from the same molecule, which is CBG.
Okay.
Right? So cannabigerol, it interacts with an enzyme that either, you know, creates CBD or that enzyme creates THC. That fundamental idea, right? That fundamental truth means that they both come from the same compound, which means that it's probably all cannabis. I guess the other way to think about it, that's your nature, right? That is the genetics. That is the enzymes. The genetics influence the enzyme production. On the other side, these cannabinoids and terpenes, a lot of people don't know, but they are actually the defense mechanisms of the mature female cannabis plants, hemp and marijuana. So we consume, right? We have these, we have an endocannabinoid system where we can consume this plant and these molecules interact with our body and can create these effects. But while they're actually in a live plant, they are defense mechanisms. They have antimicrobial properties, antifungal properties, pests. They can get rid of pests. They can bring in beneficial bugs. They can bring in pollinators. They are essentially a communicator with the environment, and the plant can't get up and walk away, but it can adjust the levels, right, of terpenes and cannabinoids to defend itself against the environment, where the outdoor environment at one point in time was more reliable, more steady, more predictable. You could grow crops outside, right? And this is to get to your point and answer your question. If I'm growing out crops outside and I know the temperature, you know, I know what it's like during the spring. I know what it's like during the summer. I know what it's like during the fall and during the winter. You bring in climate change and you have these crazy, crazy events that can destroy crops. Or they can affect the crops to do what? Produce a different level of cannabinoids and terpenes to defend against their environment. honestly, there's no perfect way to prevent, right, going over that 0.3% THC. But that's why here in Chicago, we're talking about the importance of urban agriculture, you know, and within the next 30 years, these may be the next, maybe the most important 30 years of human existence with climate change, these mass extinctions of bees and other species going on. So we really have to look at our environment, and the whole purpose of my research is to prove that indoors, right, to kind of bring everything we talked about full circle, in my mind, in urban agriculture here in Chicago, we can provide opportunities to these kids like me who are getting thrown around the city and just trying to keep up with their parents and survive without having to go, you know, take your car, right? That's the realism of it. So these opportunities through urban agriculture, climate change, there's a food shortage. We have tons of food deserts here in Chicago. I personally believe that urban agriculture, or agriculture as a whole, if we take it serious, it may be how we end up saving ourselves, saving the planet. So yeah, that's kind of to bring everything full circle and make it make sense. That is kind of where I am.
What's the meat of that program right now, the urban ag program you're doing in Chicago? Can you give some details on what that is, what it looks like, where it is?
For sure. So I'm in currently an adjunct professor at Olive Harvey College. Olive Harvey is one of the city colleges of Chicago. And Olive Harvey was granted a license to actually have a 1,500 square foot greenhouse on campus, which I'm helping set up right now. In that greenhouse, we're going to teach hemp cultivation. We have a high performance liquid chromatography machine where we're actually going to teach hemp analysis, right? How to test for pesticides and how to test for cannabinoids and different things like that. We want people to understand this is a plant, right? I kind of want to bring the cannabis conversation and dial it way, way down. I don't want to talk about consumption or anything like that. I really want to talk about the plant. So in our urban agriculture program, we have the ability, I'm currently teaching a cannabis processing class. So we literally started off with the seed, right? Talking about genetics, what's inside that seed? What is really going on? What are we looking for? And we went through the full stages of the cannabis life cycle, you know, all the specifics into the pH and how pH affects nutrients uptake. And when people learn about cannabis this way, I mean, their eyes are like, wow, you know, there's people in jail for this. A, it's a beautiful plant. B, it could probably save our lives. And C, it's much more complex than people see on the surface. So in this urban agriculture program, Olive Harvey, we have been able to do something that you don't hear about across the country. You know, you don't hear community colleges, which are supposed to be building our workforces, right? That's what community colleges are for, to teach job skills. So everybody's not meant to go to a four-year college, or maybe like myself, you may need to go to a community college before you go to a major university. So in the process, teaching people these skills, right? These urban agriculture skills, we live in a city. The realization is we're not growing outdoors here in Chicago, right? But we have tons of abandoned buildings. And if you look at vertical farming right now, there is a way to take those abandoned buildings, right? And right, bring it full circle again.
Are you cultivating anything in this greenhouse with the university outside of cannabis right now? Are you growing other things in there?
I am currently, and I always have to separate these two. So I'm doing my master's research at Chicago State University. Yep. So that's separate right now. Yep. Fingers crossed, we're waiting for a hemp cultivation license through the Illinois Department of Agriculture.
Okay.
At Olive Harvey, where I'm an instructor and helping set up the greenhouse over there, we've actually already gotten the green light to grow hemp in there. So we're developing right now. Right now we are literally getting ready to hopefully in our next semester have our first group of students go through hands-on in the greenhouse daily, internships, right? Something really fun is people are like, I'm from the city, you know, I never thought about agriculture. And it's like, well, you should, because it's not really an option anymore, right? We have to grow in cities because of food deserts, but also because of climate change. So that's kind of what we're doing. And to your point, we do want to use other crops. We want to bring people in and understand plant science. The basics of plant science should be understood, honestly, I believe, by all humans. My goal overall is to get, you know, some type of urban agriculture program minus cannabis, you know, just plants in general, at these local high schools.
Does this work overlap at all with what you're doing with the Illinois Minority Growers Association?
Yes. So there's like 30 different things I always have to hyper focus on when we're talking about, but I'm the co-founder of the Illinois Minority Growers Association. The thought process behind founding that was exactly what I said. I realized that, and I don't remember the exact percentage, but I know that nationally, 2% of our farmers nationally are people of color. And again, when I look in the inner city, I'm like, man, why are people of color the ones who are, you know, being portrayed as being violent or these different things? And I'm like, it's opportunity. We're all American at the end of the day. Me and you served in the same branch. Me and you both love our Marine Corps. So what I kind of realized was it's the lack of opportunity. Here in Chicago, we have 4 of the largest cannabis companies in the United States that chose Chicago to be their headquarters. And I don't believe it's by accident. Mm-hmm. And my thing is, I realized I was like, hey, if these companies are here and you can only, everything, little known fact, all cannabis sold in Illinois has to be grown and tested in Illinois. Well, when I heard that, I was like, well, we need to give jobs to people, right? Those growers and those testers should be these people who don't have opportunities in these in the inner city, right, in the Chicagoland area. So Illinois Minority Growers Association, you know, our pillars are education, equity, and empowerment. Through education, exactly what you're talking about. We are partnering with Olive Harvey and many other partners to kind of educate our communities, educate our ancestors, right? I grew up in a church. Cannabis was no way. Yeah, it was an easy no-brainer. And now through education, we get to teach, you know, some people. I have a lady in my class is 70 years old, and, you know, she's really learning a lot. She's like, wow, I was against cannabis, but I have ailments that may benefit from using cannabis, right? So now she's interested in planting this crop and learning more about this crop. Equity, just to make sure that people actually have a stake in this industry. Through empowerment, education, and equity, we really want to make sure people get the bigger message, but also that people just want opportunities as Americans. That's all we really want. I don't really think anybody's bad, right? Every time we see somebody who's, you know, doing something crazy, it seems like at some point in time during their life, there was something that happened that kind of set them on this path. And I really want people to have enough opportunities so we can lower the crime rate in Chicago. People have more opportunities, right? And so we understand agriculture is fun. It's fun as heck. I mean, it's really, really fun. When you live in a city that is the murder capital of the planet, seeing something come to life with your own hands is the best therapy. I don't care what anybody says. You can walk through, you know, the craziest environment, but when you get to that greenhouse, you saw it yesterday is in there waving and it's a little bigger than it was yesterday, right? You smile a little bit and you're like, all right, you know, I'm doing something right. Even when you make mistakes, right, with plants, you learn and you become better. So it is a real life therapy for veterans, for these kids in Chicago who have PTSD from being exposed to so many shootings. Yeah. I believe that this is, you know, through Illinois Minority Growers Association, we can provide those opportunities to help heal our city financially and also with our well-being.
If there are folks, Steve, that are listening that would like to support any one of those 2 or 3 initiatives, is there a way they should do that? Is there a place they can go? I mean, what would be your response to that?
Yeah, so the website for Illinois Minority Growers Association is it's ilmga.org. And the easier way to reach out, honestly, I'm very, very active on LinkedIn. Mike, you see my stuff all the time. If you reach out to me directly on LinkedIn, it's a little easier because most of my connections are on LinkedIn and we can facilitate the proper kind of pathway to assist. So please feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn. And I love networking with people.
I want to bring it back to one of the earlier points that you made, consciously or otherwise, but you described this path, I think, out of an environment that was largely outside of your control. And that path to success where you are today began at military service. I think there's a lot of expectation that, or assumption, that if you grow up in this kind of environment that you described, that there's no way out, right? That those people are, that's just their lot in life, right? But you have managed to not be a part of that statistic. How?
If you have a little bit of hope to hold on to, you know, that can keep you going through this whole thing. I mean, on paper, if you look at me up to age 18, I was destined to be a statistic. at one point, I can't tell you how many times I was suspended, detentions, not in class. I got D's. And like I said, I'm a master's student right now with a 4.0 GPA. I've gotten to work with some of the top minds in this industry. And that started, like you said, with when I saw that environment, I had people that were older than me to come to me and go, hey, you know, you don't have to go out to the streets. Mm-hmm. I see you as a young man who's just growing up in this climate. They say fake it till you make it. I hate that analogy, but the older I get, I realize it sometimes it's a real thing, and it's not fake it. It's hope. It's faith.
Yeah.
And I'm big on my faith. I'm big on hope. My fiance always says, she said, when I proposed, she said, you're very intentional with everything that you do. And every move I've made since I left Chicago as that honestly terrified 19-year-old boy who didn't have much going on, I've been very intentional that I didn't want to be a statistic. I wanted to prove everybody wrong who wrote me off. And it started off as anger for a long time, right? You want to let the haters know, you want to prove everybody wrong. But at the end of the day, I realized I was a hurt kid, just like these hurt kids. I found an opportunity through the military. These kids are looking for opportunity, right? And theirs may not be in the military. It may be through urban agriculture.
I'm hearing you describe the mindset that you developed through your military service. And I'm hearing you talk a lot about opportunity creation. And I think you're living what you're describing here with the urban agriculture, with your master's thesis, with its applicability into the veteran community, with the Illinois Minority Growers Association. These are all opportunity creation endeavors that have been created through the mindset that you built, that has its foundation in your military service, that was, I think, largely made possible by a mentor in your life, but also by recognizing that the trials that happen in your life don't have to be the nail in the coffin, right? They can be opportunities in and of themselves.
What you touch bases on, honestly, is kind of what I leave a lot of people with. I'm sure people have heard like the ancient quote, it's better to be a warrior in a garden than a gardener in a war. I always kind of joke that your trials and tribulations are like body armor. And every trial that doesn't kill you, you should look at as like, yo, you know what I've been through? I can do this. It's like, you know, as a kid, I realized that I had been exposed to way more than a lot of people had ever been exposed to in different types of exposure and different environments. And when you realize, again, that's body armor. And when I say body armor, I mean mental armor. Mm-hmm. You know, right now we're all kind of volatile, you know, there's a lot going on. But I think when we step back for a second, and, you know, I always tell people that sometimes we're so quick climbing up a ledge, climbing up the next ledge, climbing up the next ledge. When we fall from one of those ledges, we think it's the end. And it's like, hey, you've made it up 100 ledges before. You never stopped, took the time and looked back at how far you've come. Mm-hmm. And that's where I really think that adversity turns. I mean, think some of the wealthiest people on the planet, right? They want you to know that, hey, I struggled too. I worked for this. And the reason is because we respect people that have worked for it. It's the truth. We know that they have a different mindset. We know that they see things differently, right? So that is, there's a benefit in giving people who've had adverse situations an opportunity to shine. Mm-hmm. Because I'm not an anomaly. I tell people that all the time. I'm not some special, right? You know, that's the reason that I appreciated you reaching out, you know, not just us being Marines, but I wanted to speak on a platform that was neutral, right? I don't want to always speak to someone else's benefit, to someone else's motive. I kind of want people to see what it really is. I'm not some crazy anomaly. People are looking for opportunities. And sometimes when you're spiraling, you don't get a chance to hit the brakes and really see, like, you know what? I kind of see what's going on, and I'm going to be intentional about making a change. And that starts with, like you said, opportunities, mentorships, different things like that, kind of getting outside of your own circle and comfort zone. Even if your comfort zone is uncomfortable, getting outside of that, you get a bigger picture and more perspective to what the world has to offer and how you can contribute, because we all matter and we need everybody.
So much of what Steve is doing today is about opportunity creation. From his urban ag initiatives, his research in cannabis, and the Illinois Minority Growers Association. All of these are about creating opportunities for those in his community. What he lacked growing up are some of the same things he's trying to create now. Steve's path to get here is one that I have much respect for. He turned his negative experiences with opioids into opportunities to educate himself on the connection between the body and the brain. This, coupled with the unfortunate loss of a close friend, led him to explore the opportunities inherent in the cannabis plant to serve as an effective alternative to the same drug that had been at the root of all of these trials in his life. Instead of hiding from them, he attacked them head on. His point about policy not aligning with the plant science is a valid one. Where did this seemingly arbitrary 0.3% THC threshold come from? Why hasn't policy taken into account the impact of environmental changes? Why have some states taken so long to see the medical benefits of marijuana while others were quick to adopt its use? Now, I'm not a plant scientist or a policymaker, but I bet it has something to do with a failure to look at the complete system. All of Steve's decisions, from leaving Chicago a scared 19-year-old kid to today, have been intentional and filled with hope. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from these stories and insights, please leave us a review and share on social media. You can also find previous episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website at agdconsult.com. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike DeSa, and until next time, stay frosty.